Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with security shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. We already know what happened to 28-year-old Sandra Bland back in 2015. Texas State Trooper Brian Encinia pulls her over for failing to signal a lane change. He escalates the situation, pulling a taser on her and threatening to light her up. He claims he feared for his personal safety. He arrested Bland, and several days later, she died in jail by suicide. Until recently, the first and only video the public saw of the incident came from the dash cam of Encinia's cruiser. That is what law enforcement officials released at the time. The cell phone video, now public, though, tells the story from inside Bland's car, from her point of view. And it reminds us who owns the story in the early days of a high-profile incident like this, about how that story might evolve or change as more video comes out, sometimes years after the fact. This hour on Point, videos, evolving narratives, and getting at the truth in police encounters gone wrong. And you can join us. Law enforcement officials are America's first responders. They shoulder that risk and carry that responsibility. But should they also be the first narrators of events to the public, especially controversial ones? And how do we get at the truth of what really happened in a timely way? Join us anytime on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us first today from Austin, Texas, is Brian Collister, chief investigative reporter for the nonprofit investigative reporting organization, The Investigative Network. It was his reporting that led to the public release of Sandra Bland's cell phone video, and you have a link to all of his work at onpointradio.org. Brian Collister, welcome to the program.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, tell us, why did law enforcement officials or prosecutors not release this version, this cell phone video, near or about the time where they released that dash cam video back in 2015?
Well, I've been covering the Bland case since it happened in 2015, and what I can tell you about that dash camera video and when it was released shortly after the controversy started. Normally in Texas, a dash cam video of any incident in which there is either an alleged crime or whether there is a lawsuit is not public information. Mm. You can't get it. The police will deny it. The state attorney general will back them up on that. In this instance, there was so much outrage over what had happened to Sandra Bland and concern that our state lawmakers essentially forced our head of our Texas Department of Public Safety, and I've seen the emails from State Senator Royce West to Steve McGraw, the head of our DPS at the time. It said, you need to release this video.
Yeah.
And so they did it under pressure from the state as well as the public that was reacting. So it normally would not have been public information.
I see.
So that's just the dash cam video.
Okay. So then that perhaps then explains why the cell phone video was never willingly offered up to the public.
Well, that's part of the equation. The other part is that when the dash cam video was put out to the world and DPS uploaded it to their YouTube page, they didn't have the cell phone video yet.
Mm.
So the sort of chain of custody, if you will, that I've been able to piece together is Sandra was pulled over and arrested. Her phone was in her purse that was locked in the trunk of her car. Her car was then towed. She died 3 days later. The FBI and the Texas Rangers came in a joint investigation, and the FBI took possession of the purse. It was then given to the Texas Rangers. That's when a search warrant was issued, and they gave it back to the FBI for their forensics lab. And then it was about 2 months later, 66 days later, that the DPS had that cell phone video, but didn't bother to share it or show it to anyone, publicly at least.
Okay. So there are a lot of details to dig in here, Brian, and I'm so grateful you could join us to help us navigate through them. But I do want to listen back to that event in 2015. But first, what we're going to do is we're going to hear from the video audio from the dash cam video that was released in 2015. And this is near the beginning of the encounter, or I should say after State Trooper Encinia has written up the ticket for Sandra Bland and approaches her car again. So this is the first part of when the encounter rapidly escalates. And again, this is from the dash cam video that was released in 2015, and as always, folks, I just want to issue the warning that it is a very intense audio you're about to hear. It may not be appropriate for everyone, but here it is, the first part of the encounter.
You mind putting out your cigarette, please? Don't mind.
I'm in my car. Why do I have to put out my cigarette?
Well, you can step on out now.
I don't have to step out of my car.
Step out of the car. Step out of the car.
No, you don't have the right.
Step out of the car.
You do not have the right to do that.
I do have the right. Now step out or I will remove you.
I refuse to talk to you other than to identify myself.
Step out or I will remove you.
I am getting removed for a failure.
Step out or I will remove you. I'm giving you a lawful order. Get out of the car now or I'm going to remove you.
And I'm calling my lawyer.
I'm going to yank you out of here.
Okay, you're going to yank me out of my car?
Get out.
Okay.
That is the first part of the dash cam video that was released in 2015. That dash cam video does go on to show the remainder of how State Trooper, former State Trooper Encinia arrested Sandra Bland. But let's listen now to the cell phone video, audio from the cell phone video that Sandra Bland herself took of the incident. And it picks up very quickly from the point that we left off here. So here's the audio from Sandra Bland's own cell phone.
Get out of the car now.
Why am I being apprehended? You trying to give me a ticket
said,
for the failure?
Get out of the car.
Why am I being apprehended? You just opened my car door. You just opened my car door. So you're threatening to drag me out of my own car.
Get out of the car.
And then you're going to stun me?
I will light you up. Get out.
Wow.
Now.
Wow.
Get out of the car.
Really, for a failure to signal. You're doing all of this for
get
a failure to signal.
Get over there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Let's take this to court. Let's do
Go
it.
Ahead.
For a failure to signal. Yep, for a failure to signal.
Get off the phone.
On my school.
Get off the phone.
I'm not on the phone. I have a right
Put
to record. This
down.
Is my property. This
Put
is
your
my
phone
property.
Down.
Sir?
Put your phone down right now.
Audio from Sandra Bland's own cell phone video that she took during her arrest in 2015. I have to say this is one of those limitations of radio because I think the power of the video is in seeing the encounter from her point of view, Brian Collister. But what is the significance of her cell phone video? Because factually, I don't see it having revealed anything else about the encounter that we didn't already know.
Well, all along throughout the entire process, even though it wasn't said publicly, but during the criminal investigation of the trooper, during the administrative investigation by DPS of the trooper, during the civil federal lawsuit by the family, Encinia was communicating his defense, which is, I was in fear for my safety. After everything was said and done, I was able to obtain the audio of his interviews with their internal investigators, and he repeatedly said over and over and over again, I didn't know what was in her hands. I thought she might have a weapon. I was in fear for my safety. What this video that Sandra shot herself, and she knew the power of a phone. She, you know, we've all seen her her videos that she posted on Facebook, and you can almost hear her narrating the video. Mm. Oh, you want to do this? Oh, you're gonna. I mean, she is at that moment pointing the phone at him. So, what the family, what the attorney have all said, and now the video's out. Lots and lots of other people have felt when they've seen it because it's like looking at the trooper through Sandra's own eyes when you watch that video. It's stunning. Is that he's clearly not in fear for his safety. He clearly knows what's in her hand. She's sticking the phone in his face. So that's what this changes about the narrative. You know, the family always believed the trooper was not telling the truth when he said that he was fearing for his safety. And now what they're saying when they see this video is, aha, finally, we have the proof. You can see, you're in the cab of the car, and you can see that he knows where her hands are. He knows what she's doing. And clearly, when you look at his face and when he whips that taser out and points it right in the camera in Sandra's face,
right,
he doesn't look like a guy that's scared.
Yeah. I mean, it is very powerful, even terrifying, like you said, to see it from her point of view, from her camera. But didn't Ancinia hadn't he already found to have perjured himself in claiming that he was in fear for his life well before this cell phone video came out as a result of your reporting? I mean, that claim was already shown to just be not true.
So the perjury charge actually comes directly from his arrest affidavit.
Uh-huh.
And obviously I don't know it word for word, but okay, essentially it was pulled over, bland, she became belligerent, I arrested her, you know, something like that. So the grand jurors watched the dash cam video, and he was indicted for his description of events in his arrest report. He may or may not, I can't recall, have said, I felt threatened. I don't recall. Now, he certainly did after the fact. But the perjury charge was directly related to his description of the events, which the grand jury at the time did not believe matched the dash cam video. Now, here's where it gets interesting. At that time, which would have been January of 2016 when he was indicted, early January, we simply don't know whether those grand jurors in Waller County, Texas, which is northwest of Houston, had been shown this cell phone video. Prosecutors, just before we aired our story, one of the five special prosecutors that were appointed confirmed for me that they did have the video. And when I asked, well, did you show it to the grand jurors? Because certainly that's an amazing perspective. And why would you not want to share that with them? And what I was told by the special prosecutor was that they couldn't talk about that because grand jury proceedings are secret. Oh. So we don't know if the grand jury ever saw that video.
But we do know that mention of the video was in documentation gathered during discovery, though.
Well, that is the debate right now. What you'll hear later in the program from the attorney for the family is when they did discovery, it was not in there.
Okay. So, Brian, we're going to keep you with us then because these are important details that we need to sort out. Brian Collister, stand by. He's the chief investigative reporter and CEO of the Investigative Network. He's joining us from Austin, Texas, and it's Brian's reporting that made public the video from Sandra Bland's cell phone of her 2015 arrest. And once again, it's raising the question of narratives that immediately are formed around very high-profile and controversial police arrests. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the cell phone video from Sandra Bland's own cell phone. She was the woman who was arrested in Texas in a very high-profile arrest in 2015. High-profile because of the manner of the arrest and the fact that Sandra Bland died by suicide in jail a couple of days ago, after her arrest. Again, 4 years later, it was the work of Brian Collister, chief investigative reporter and CEO of the Investigative Network, that made public, that forced the public release of Sandra Bland's cell phone video. And Brian joins us today from Austin, Texas. And we're asking about this bigger picture of evolving narratives, especially around high-profile police arrests, especially when certain video that can help us access the truth comes months or even years after a high-profile police incident. And joining us now from Chicago, Illinois, is Cannon Lambert. He's a lawyer who's represented the Bland family since Sandra Bland's death in 2015. Cannon Lambert, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
So first of all, you've said that the first time you saw this video from Sandra Bland's cell phone was after Brian Collister got it released. You hadn't seen it before at all?
That's right. Brian was the first person to share the video with us. Obviously, we had asked for video through the discovery and expected that we would get it. And so I was a little surprised to see the video. You know, that was recently most shown.
Okay, so you asked for the video through discovery, meaning you knew of its existence.
Well, we didn't, you know, initially what happened was that there was a big fight over whether or not we were going to get the Ranger report. And so the Ranger report entails a whole host of pieces of information. We asked for the Ranger report. We asked for any and all video, any and all audio, any and all transmittals from the dispatch and the like. And so it would have and should have been included in those requests. I mean, on a practical level, I will say, I know that they were suggesting that they sent it to us, they gave it to us, but I can tell you that the first time that I saw it was when Brian shared it with us.
Yeah, so just to be clear, I mean, from Brian's reporting, I see here that officials, as you just mentioned, Cannon Lambert, officials say they provided all the evidence required of them as part of the lawsuit, and quote, an investigative report mentions the cell phone video, but the mention is buried more than 60 pages into the document. I mean, I'm just wondering, what's your response to the question that sort of more aggressive lawyering and specific requests for this cell phone video might have yielded more fruit for you?
Yeah, I think our work speaks for itself as to the aggressive nature of how it is we approached this case. I will say that it doesn't make a lot of sense for them to have withheld it. It's an odd thing, right? Because if you think about it from this standpoint, the Texas Tort Claims Act, it sets up that we are limited to $100,000 from the Texas Rangers. That's what the statute limits us to. And they tendered that $100,000 even without us having the video. So it strikes me as odd that they, you know, that they would have any motivation. That being said, I can tell you that it wasn't just me that didn't see it. It was also my co-counsel, Larry Rogers, that didn't see it. And so it would have been three different law firms that would not have seen it because Tom Rhodes didn't see it either. That being said, I would say that the most concerning piece of it to me is that, as I understand it, the special prosecutors did see it, did have it, and did have occasion to incorporate it into their process. And the special prosecutors were the individuals that were responsible for bringing charges against Brian and Senia. And how this video, I don't know whether or not the video was used, but how they would decide to walk away from pursuing the charge of perjury in light of having this information is sort of beyond me.
So, Cannon Lambert, what are you and the family then saying now that that prosecutors, I mean, is that what you're saying, that prosecutors simply failed to mount the most aggressive or effective or just prosecution here, and that's what the video changes shows in your mind?
I'll tell you what I'm saying and what I think what the family is saying. We met with the special prosecutors at their request, in fact, at their badgering the very first time that Mr. Encinia was in court. They approached me three different times begging to meet with us. And when we did meet with them, they wanted to meet with us even before his hearing commenced, and we wanted to see the hearing, of course. Then during the meeting, they tapped me on the arm wanting to have us come and talk to them. And then after the hearing, while Ms. Geneva and I were being met by other people who were in support of Sandy, they wanted to meet with us. Well, we did meet with them. And in that meeting, I made it explicitly clear, and so too did the family, that it was our expectation that they would prosecute this claim, this charge of perjury, and that we would rather see them prosecute the charge and lose than cut a deal. They promised Ms. Geneva, they promised Shante Needham that they would do that, and they didn't.
Brian Collister, step back in here. I mean, what have Texas officials told you about what Cannon Lambert is asserting here?
Well, so far we've been told what you mentioned earlier, which is that the Department of Public Safety, which in this case was a defendant, and then their representative, which would have been our Texas Attorney General's office, they were their attorney. And they have both put out statements that everything was provided. What I find interesting, and everyone has asked me, you know, what do you think? And obviously we're still trying to sort it all out, but I can certainly tell you that when I spoke to Cannon Lambert and in Chicago and Tom Rhodes, who was one of their legal representatives in San Antonio separately, I spoke to both of them separately. Both of them said the same thing. Where in the world did you get that video? Neither one had seen it. So that's two out of six of the attorneys that represented the family who told me when I produced it to them that they had no idea. They'd never seen it. The other thing that you should keep in mind is that this was not an open process. In this instance, the federal court sealed all of the evidence that the family was shown, put a gag order in place. They couldn't share it or talk about it. And then when the case was settled, they were put in a position of returning everything they'd been given. So we have no documents to go back to. We had no hearing in open court where it's plain and simple.
Is that so common? Because the question that keeps popping up in my mind is why? I mean, is that so, par for the course in these kinds of cases? Cannon Lambert, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, just quickly, just as a technical aspect, Brian and Substance is right that there was a protective order that was in place that required that after the resolution of the civil case, we were required to destroy or eliminate the presence of any of the evidence that we had. So we no longer have what was initially sent to us. But I guess the bigger focus to me, candidly speaking, I mean, I tend to focus and train my interest in and on instances where prosecutors have the ability to support families, but they lack the moral will to follow through on their legal obligations, like in this situation where they had every obligation in my mind to prosecute Mr. Insignia, but because they didn't want to ultimately do so for various reasons, they ended up cutting a deal with him. And they tried to suggest that they had done a good thing because now he could not be a police officer in the state of Texas. That fails to recognize that he can be a police officer in other states, and it fails to recognize that it may not be a lifetime scenario because there's no order that requires or limits his ability to do so. And when you've got when you talk about controlling the narrative, it to me is a very, very important thing because at the very inception of police involved shootings, you've got demonizing of victims, and you've got a failure to release all of the information, but instead a release of choice information, and they bolster the official positions of the authorities in an effort to try and create a mindset in the public. And that's, to me, where there really needs to be a focus.
Right. Well, Cannon Lambert, one last question for you. So what specifically does the family want now?
Well, I think the family really wants there to be a real and consistent effort to evaluate how policing is done and police reforms they want to see put into place. Because if you do those things, if you train police officers correctly, if you terminate police officers when they perjure themselves in court or when they create false police reports, then what you do is you change the entire policing environment so that everybody, when they engage with police, can feel like they're getting a fair shake. Mm.
Cannon Lambert joining us from Chicago. He's a lawyer who's represented the Bland family since Sandra Bland's death in 2015. Thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you so much. And thank you, Brian.
Let's take a quick call here. Ken is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Ken, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I was just wondering. I mean, I'm listening here, and I didn't catch all of the program. However, my question is, from what I understand, the police officer asked the woman to get out of the car, and she denied to do that. And I believe our police officers have the right to ask people to step out of their cars if need be. Now, you're looking at a video of the whole situation, and obviously it's heated, and it's, you know, there's words that are exchanged. However, the fact remains that the police officer gave this person an order to get out of her vehicle, and she denied it. So I don't understand if she denied, you know, his order. First of all, why wouldn't he feel that anything at that point could happen? And if he was saying fearing for his life is a possibility, then fearing for his life, I believe, is a possibility. So my question to the attorney there, Ken, is forget about the perjuring part, because that's afterwards. I'd like him to explain to me how a person has the ability to deny an order from a police officer, because these are the laws that we live by.
Right.
And how do you get around that and say she was justified in not obeying a order from a police officer who stopped her for committing what is also a law offense?
Yeah, so Ken, this is actually a really important question. We've let go of Ken Lambert, but I have another legal scholar who can help us answer it, because I think there's some presumptions about when and where police officers have the right to have some request someone to exit their call, so their car. So Ken, thank you for that call, and we're going to have that your question answered right now by Paul Butler. He joins us today from Miami. He's a professor at Georgetown Law School and a former federal prosecutor. He's also author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Paul Butler, welcome to you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So I do want to get to the bigger question that we're asking about narratives that evolve around cases like this. But Ken has asked a very specific question about the moment a person refuses to exit their vehicle, is an officer justified in saying that he or she feared for their lives?
So under the law, during a traffic stop, the police are allowed to order the driver and the passenger to get out of the car. But after the traffic stop ends, the police don't have that authority. And if you look at the video, you see the officer come back to the car and hand Ms. Bland the ticket. At that point, the traffic stop is over. The cop gets an attitude because he doesn't like the way that Ms. Bland responds to him. He orders her to put out the cigarette. He can't do that because the traffic encounter is over. She is free to leave. The other issue is his excessive use of force. Mm. And so we see him point the stun gun at Ms. Bland. Now, she doesn't have any weapon at all, so that's an unreasonable use of force. And so, bottom line, street law lesson here, during the traffic stop, yes, the police do have that authority. After the traffic stop ends, you are free to go.
Okay. So let's take a step back now and get to this bigger question, because it seems to happen over and over and over again that we have an incident that happens during an arrest. And I know I use the word incident broadly, right? Sometimes these incidents end in the deaths of the people being arrested. And time and again, the first version of the story we hear, as is typical, is from law enforcement themselves. And then in the months or even years later, as is shown here by the work of Brian Collister, we have other versions, other pictures, videos that come out over time that give us a fuller sense of the actual event that happened. So Paul Butler, my big story is, how do we navigate, how do we handle what now seems to be repeated cases of emerging or changing narratives in these incidents?
So the blue wall of silence means that when cops themselves are suspected of breaking the law, police close ranks. There's no stronger code of don't be a snitch than among law enforcement officers. And law and policy can also prevent the truth from getting out. So if you look at police union contracts, police get to control the narrative because under these contracts, they talk to union representatives and lawyers before they make any statement. Sometimes the cop who did the shooting or used the force is made aware of what other witnesses have said. And then we see that victims and other witnesses are demonized. It's blamed the victim. The suggestion is that they had it coming. So cops get this elaborate procedure that almost no other suspect in a criminal case ever gets.
Mm. Brian Collister, you want to respond to that?
I think that's, you know, they're in control of everything. I mean, they're in control of the narrative. They're in control of the stop. And I think, you know, the caller, although the question is certainly justified, there always is a presumption that because someone has a badge and a gun that they can do no wrong. And so then the blame shifts to the person that they've stopped. And I think that that's something that needs to change.
Mm. But Paul Butler, what other system might we have when at the same time you're talking about laws and policies? I imagine that law enforcement would also say in every single one of these cases there were ongoing investigations as well. So there are lots of things that they couldn't have said even if they wanted to.
Well, that's not true. So the police report to the mayor. The police chief is usually appointed by the mayor. And we've seen because of the activism and the movement for Black Lives, the politics are changing. And so now in many high-profile cases, we see evidence, including cell phone video, released almost immediately. And when it's not, like in Chicago with the shooting of Laquan McDonald, there are consequences because that evidence wasn't immediately made public. The mayor is no longer running for re-election. There's a new mayor. And the district attorney in Chicago, she didn't get re-elected.
Hmm. And we should note, by the way, that today, in the latest in another high-profile case, the death of Eric Garner in New York City, the police officer who put his arm around Eric Garner's neck is facing a disciplinary trial. That, too, is happening today. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the cell phone video that Sandra Bland took of her own arrest in 2015. Sandra Bland was arrested and died later by suicide in a jail cell in Texas. It was the work of Brian Collister, chief investigative reporter and CEO of the Investigative Network, a nonprofit reporting organization that finally got that cell phone release made public just recently. And Brian's reporting, there's a link to it at onpointradio.org. And we want to hear from you because we're asking this big picture question about how is it that we can understand and analyze and deal with emerging and evolving narratives that come about with these very high-profile police-related incidents. And what does it mean that sometimes the whole truth regarding video or pictures doesn't come out until months or years later? Love to hear from you, especially if you're a member of law enforcement. Want your point of view here as well. Brian Collister joins us from Austin, Texas today. Paul Butler is also with us. He's a professor at Georgetown University Law Center, a former federal prosecutor, and author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. And Brian and Paul, if I may, I just want to play a little bit of tape from another incident that really underscores this question that we're asking. This was from 2014 when 17-year-old Laquan McDonald was shot and killed by Chicago police. Now, initial police reports claimed that McDonald lunged at officers with a knife and his death was ruled justifiable. But here is ABC7 reporter Rob Elgus describing what videos that were released 3 months later, what those videos revealed.
This is Jason Van Dyke's police SUV, recorded by another squad car, trailing him as they weave through traffic, rushing to a report of a man wielding a knife. Now we're inside Van Dyke's vehicle. This blurry dash cam video reveals something we had not seen until today. Laquan McDonald running from police.
So that video showed that McDonald posed no threat to officers. It showed Officer Jason Van Dyke firing 11 times and hitting McDonald 9 times. Van Dyke was just sentenced this year to 6 years and 9 months in prison for second-degree murder. So, Paul Butler, I mean, what are the things that you recommend be done for the public to be able to better get at the truth in a more timely manner?
So part of it is already happening. It's the reason why we're discussing the Sandra Bland case, Laquan McDonald, all of these high-profile cases of police violence. It happened in 2012. That's the year that for the first time, more than half of Americans own smartphones. Mm-hmm. And so for communities of color, this allows for on-the-ground reporting of our everyday lived experiences, which often involve the police, police shootings, police physical and verbal abuse. And so we saw Sandra Bland, an African-American woman. She was armed with nothing but a cell phone, and she used it to narrate the horror, the violence, the abuse. When that cop said, "I will light you up," for people who don't believe the cops talk to people like that, now the whole world knows.
Hmm. Brian Collister, you worked at this for a long time. Is there a balance between the best interests of an ongoing investigation and the public's right to know in cases like this?
Well, as a huge advocate for transparency, I think any and all information in a police-involved use of force or shooting should be made public immediately. Of course, there are legal scholars who defend officers who will say, "Well, you can't do that. You're going to prejudice the case." So I'm not quite sure where that balance is. But you know, I hope that we're not in a situation where the true answer of what happens in these cases moving forward is from the cell phone of a dead person. And it's very difficult with me, being a white male. When I get pulled over, I have a fear of law enforcement in the sense that I'm afraid I'm going to have to take defensive driving. It's an eye-opener for me to understand that people of color don't know if they're going to make it home alive. And so I think that more people need to understand the sensitivity, and that goes to the officers. You know, the Bland family fought for DPS to include in their settlement de-escalation training, and I think that is specifically in this case what you see on her cell phone video and even on the dash cam video was that officer escalated it. You know, at one point he says, "Are you okay?" And she says, "Well, no, I'm not okay. You pulled me over. I tried to get over to the right lane, and you pulled me over for not using my signal. But you were right on. You pulled up right behind me." And then he looks at her and goes, "Are you done?" I mean, he's punching her buttons, is the term that I would use, and trying intentionally to agitate. Whereas there is a 7-step violator contact procedure that the officers are required to use, and he did not. Mm. And so I think in instances like that, the officer contributes to it, and then a lot of people will look at these instances and say that Sandra Bland contributed to it, that she should have just kept her mouth shut, put her hands at 10 and 2 and taken whatever it was. Mm-hmm. It's a multifaceted problem, and it's going to take people resolving each one of those facets to try to stop this, right? Because it seems to be rampant.
Well, let's take a bunch of calls here. Let's go to Hillary, who's calling from Middletown, Connecticut. Hillary, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, and thanks for the conversation, Megna, on this important issue, and Brian for unearthing this important video. I wanted to respond and ask a question specifically related to Ken, the caller who asked why didn't she simply get out, and the conversation we've been having just now about the difference in policing for Black people and white people. I'm an African-American woman, and so is my mother. My father is white, but it was a terrifying video to watch for many Black women. And, there's another video that people rarely watch related to this stop, which is the one that's 49 minutes long. It includes the stop that Officer Insignia made before he pulled over Sandra Bland. And if you'd like to watch that video, you can see directly the difference in his intonation and his level of empathy for the non-minority person who he pulls over, who is also a student. And he asks her questions about, what classes she's taking, and she doesn't have a registration in the car. the difference between the behavior that he exhibited to Sandra Bland is completely different, and you can watch them juxtaposed just a few minutes. It's remarkable. This is about empathy and racism and police training, and that is what we've just heard that the family wants. So I'm happy to hear her comments on that, and thank you for taking my call.
Hillary, thank you for your call. Paul Butler, what would you like to say?
Study after study affirms that the police talk to African-American and Latinx people very differently than how they talk to white folks. And again, we've got lots of evidence of this from body cams that police are often required to use and also from cell phone videos. You know, the larger issue goes to a point that President Obama's task force on 21st century policing made, and that's that police culture needs to change. The problem, Obama's commission said, is that cops think of themselves like warriors, especially in communities of color. Their mentality is it's us against them. And in a democracy, police shouldn't look at citizens as enemy combatants. And so President Obama's commission said they ought to instead think of themselves as guardians, as caretakers of the community. And if you think about that, that would change the kind of people who want to be cops, how they interact with citizens, and especially how they're perceived in communities of color, if they do go to that guardian mindset rather than that warrior mentality.
Well, Paul Butler, I want to explore with you in detail something else that Brian Collister reminded of us in this case, because it's very, very common that there was the immediate claim made by the officer that he was in fear for his safety. I mean, in case after case, we hear this. This is the claim that officers make. And in many, many situations, one can imagine that that's absolutely true, because split-second decisions have to be made. There's a cloud of uncertainty when events are moving fast. Totally understandable. But there are also cases that end up in court where ultimately video evidence is presented that really sort of weakens this argument that the officers were in fear for their safety or their lives. And yet, in almost every single one of those cases, those officers have been found innocent. It's been a successful defense. Is there a problem there?
Absolutely. So police kill about 1,000 people a year. In the last 15 years, fewer than 80 police officers have been prosecuted for murder or manslaughter, and the majority of those were not convicted. In the cases that have been charged, most of the officers have been white, and in 2 out of 3 cases, the person who was killed is African American. So if you look at that video or even the audio we heard, why in the world would the officer have feared for his life from Sandra Bland? She was on her way to a new job. She called the officer, sir. She had a cell phone. She didn't have any gun. But we know that often officers' perceptions are informed by race, stereotypes about an angry black woman or a black male thug. And so I think it's revealing that one of the few cases in which there has been a conviction of an officer recently for killing somebody was in Minneapolis. And the officer was a non-black man named Muhammad Noor, and he killed an Australian woman. The prosecution got a conviction in that case. They emphasized that the woman was blonde. How could they have feared? How could the police have feared for their lives for a blonde woman? I think that tells us everything we need to know about the calculus in these cases.
It makes me wonder if, I mean, are we not at a point or long past the point where, you know, in press conference after press conference, when these incidents occurs, and we see not just the officers involved in the incident, in fact, they're never in the press conferences, but their superiors, you know, the chiefs of police in these cities, standing up and putting out a certain narrative, which later is contradicted by video evidence that emerges. I mean, there's the public's confidence in law enforcement certainly is undermined, is it not?
It absolutely is. We can think when we look at these videos of their evidence to two different groups of people. One is folks who just didn't believe that the police acted like this. Their experience is that they call the cops when there are cats in a tree and the police officers come and get the cat out the tree. Now they know. And in many instances, they care. They're appalled. They understand that it's about race relations, but it's also about a democracy and how much power the police should have in a democracy and how transparent and accountable they should be. Unfortunately, there's another group of people who will always give the police the benefit of the doubt. They'll blame the victims. They'll think that the police were just trying to do their jobs. And so that's a harder group to reach. Again, the more optimistic way of thinking about this is the Movement for Black Lives has been incredibly savvy at focusing attention on these issues, and they're making a difference. We're seeing this wave of progressive prosecutors in places like Chicago and Baltimore who believe communities of color and want the police to be more accountable.
Brian Collister, in the last couple of minutes that we have, I'd like you to help us understand sort of where this all leaves us in Texas right now, because Paul Butler was saying earlier that this can all be changed. The situations can be improved with changes to laws and policies. So first of all, do I understand this correctly, that in Texas they're considering changing the law such that officers, except only under very particular circumstances, would not even be allowed to arrest people for traffic stops?
That was a piece of legislation that was taking place last week, and last Friday it died in the legislature. And our story sort of coincided with that very moment, and people were referencing it as a good example of why officers should not be able to arrest people for low-level traffic citations. We have a very, very red state. We have a very powerful police-backed organization that lobbies, and they don't go to hearings and walk up to the microphone and say how they feel. They don't protest. They do it all behind the closed doors. And when the people that represent law enforcement go to our high-up elected officials and say, we don't like that piece of legislation, the Bland Act is a perfect example. The Bland Act initially included not just help for mental health issues when someone is checked in, which related to the Bland case, but all of the provisions that were designed essentially to detect and root out and retrain, in some cases, officers who were found to be profiling, all of that was stripped out of the bill. And that shows you the power of the police organizations in terms of their influence with lawmakers.
Now, as Cannon and Lambert told us earlier, the family wants this case reopened. Has there been any – and there's been a lot of high-profile politicians calling for that too. Any traction on that? Or can that even be done given that that the officer has agreed to never be in law enforcement again?
I think the legal question as to whether or not it can be done is more appropriate for someone like Paul, and I would love to hear his answer because I've been getting that question a lot. What I can tell you is that before our legislature convenes, and they only meet every 2 years, but we're in about the last 2 weeks of the legislature, there will be a hearing. Our DPS, our Attorney General's office, will be brought in front of the committee that is chaired by the author of the Bland Act. At this point, it looks like we're going to have a lot of finger pointing. We gave it to them. No, you didn't give it to us. And we may not be left with any more insight. But I'd love to hear from Paul as to whether or not legally that case could be reopened, because, yes, a lot of people are asking for that.
Well, Paul Butler, we have a minute to go. You want to help us out here?
Can that officer be arrested and charged for a crime based on the way that he treated Ms. Bland? The answer legally is absolutely yes. From a political perspective, there's a whole different calculus. The issue there is whether an elected prosecutor in Texas would want to bring that case. And there the answer isn't as encouraging for people who want to see justice for Sandra Bland.
Well, Paul Butler, professor at Georgetown University Law Center, former federal prosecutor and author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Brian Collister, chief investigative reporter and CEO of the Investigative Network, a nonprofit reporting organization whose efforts made public or led to the public release of Sandra Bland's cell phone video. We have links to Brian's reporting at onpointradio.org. Brian Collister, thank you.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Mm-hmm. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.